I-94 on Lumpen Radio.
And good morning, everyone, once again. As always, my name is Jamie Trecker. I am one of the hosts of I-94. And, of course, I am joined, as I am every week at Sunday at 11 o'clock in the morning, by Jeremy Kitchen.
Good morning.
Michael Sack.
Good morning, everybody.
How you guys all doing today? Today, we are joined by the author, Jim Gower. He is joining us by phone. He is the author of Novel Explosives from Zero Gram Press. We're very excited to have him on the show. Jim, welcome to I-94.
Hi, guys. How are you?
It's great to have you here, sir. Really do appreciate it. For those of you that don't know, Novel Explosives is a book that came out a couple years ago. I don't think I'm giving away any secrets by saying it is a doorstop of a book. It's around 750 pages long. It is a dense read, and we're going to get into exactly what the book is about. But, Jim, I want to talk about you, first of all, if we could, just to introduce you to our listeners. You describe yourself, in some ways, as a Marxist venture capitalist as your day job, and I must ask, what does that mean?
yeah, obvious contradiction. And so I have made my living as a venture capitalist for the last three decades. My mother was a computer scientist and was one of the founders of one of the great technology companies of the 1960s, Scientific Data Systems. So I grew up programming and working on computers and technology, and had this long sort of dual career as a computer scientist, businessman, and eventually venture capitalist, while at the same time being a poet and then eventually a novelist. So bit schizophrenic, but in any case, in the course of that part of my life, which was dedicated to literature, I did a lot of reading and the entire history of philosophy, but more recently in 20th century, the sort of neo-Marxist tradition that maybe begins with Gramsci and goes on with Adorno and Horkheimer, Marcuse, and people like that, traditionally called the New Left. These are mostly critiques of the ways in which Marx originally posited that man, the self, is economically determined, and what they extend this to is the ways in which the self is determined by the discourse or culture or systems of signification or whatever. So I'm probably the only venture capitalist who's sat in on a board meeting quoting Antonio Gramsci or Adorno and having everybody look at me sort of puzzled. But
sounds like a safe bet.
I'm not taking that one.
There is actually a funny story about me quoting something that wasn't actually from Gramsci, and the board meeting stopped and everybody said, repeat that. This was a phrase that Gramsci had cribbed from Roman Roland, the French writer, which is pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. And this was, in fact, not Gramsci, but it was the motto of the communist newspaper before Mussolini. Gramsci was imprisoned eventually by Mussolini and spent the last 27 years of his life in prison. So this idea of pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will was a difficult one for him to sustain in Mussolini's prisons. In any case, the board meeting stopped. Everyone said, say that again. And this all got written down. And about 4 or 5 years later, I start hearing everybody from motivational speakers to people like Bill Moyer using some messed up version of pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, and attributing it to Gramsci instead of Roman Roland. So I had a pretty good idea that from that board meeting that quote sort of spread out with Gramsci's name attached to it. And I don't know, I found that humorous at least. So, yes, in any case, I'm deeply conflicted, having made my living in business and in the whole machinery of capitalism, while at the same time being, let's say, a critic of that machinery.
And in fact, if listeners pay attention, one of the readings that is coming up, it's actually from page 288, Jim actually has that quote and talks about Gramsci in Mussolini's prison. You're going to hear that coming up later on one of our readings.
Is that the actual reading today?
It is one of the actual readings today. It's, yeah. Yeah,
we're in tune, Jim. We're in tune.
We're on the same wavelength here, Jim.
I hope you guys are going to read that because I don't have the book in front of me.
Well, so. Jim, actually, all our readings are done for us, as always, by Shanna Van Volt, with music this week from the local Chicago supergroup Dos Santos. So we will be getting to that in a little
bit.
Beautiful, produced reading. So I want to just follow up. Listeners obviously are probably, if they haven't already turned the radio off and fled, have probably figured out that this is a novel of big ideas, and we're going to be talking about a lot of those ideas. There's a lot of dense philosophy. Another reviewer I noted remarked that some passages of this book read like they came out of Jane's Military Goods. There are a lot of recitations of armaments and stuff like that. I did want to ask you before we go any further, and Jim, I know you're a California guy. One of the people that did come up in my mind, and I happen to be a big fan of his, is Thomas Pynchon. Thomas obviously has written a number of books that are kind of dense, layered novels that deal a lot with ideas, philosophies, ideas, thoughts, and go in kind of circular patterns. Your book, also like Pynchon's work, has a lot of humor in it. I found many passages in the book that I thought were absolutely hysterical. There's a passage actually about eating a gordita in here we're going to hear in a little bit as well. But I wanted to ask you, is there something in the California water that makes people want to write these very dense books with allusions to Wittgenstein and Gramsci and all these other things?
Yeah, probably. In fact, Pynchon and I lived not too far apart from each other in Manhattan Beach for a while. I was probably about 15 blocks from where he lived in Manhattan Beach. So it may be specifically the Manhattan Beach water. So,
well, there is that big, if I remember right, there's a big fuel depot near there. It's from El Segundo wafting down the beach, if I recall.
Yeah, exactly.
Could be the petroleum refinery.
Maybe it's some sort of toxic event floating over us. I don't know. But, yeah, Pynchon is... Pynchon is a sort of point of reference, I think, for novel explosives. I mean, I love Gravity's Rainbow, and I've read all of Pynchon. I would say Pynchon's sense of humor is maybe slightly more slapstick than mine. My humor tends to have maybe a little more of a angry edge to it. At the same time, Pynchon's not at all afraid of big ideas. I don't think Novel Explosives is as difficult to read as Gravity's Rainbow. When I first read it, I was like baffled I didn't even know who was in certain scenes. You know, you have unreferenced pronouns, you know, he and she, and something's going on in the Blitz in London, and you know, it took a couple of readings and maybe some skeleton keys to figure out who's actually even in a scene. What I tried to do with this book was maybe use Pynchon, but try to make it easier for the reader to be fully present to the scene. So while there's a lot of philosophy and all that, there's no elusiveness. I'm not referring to anything that you need in terms of philosophy. I put in the book. I don't allude to others' ideas. Now, that may not make it any less baffling, but, you know, I don't like the idea that people feel the book is sort of elsewhere. You know, it's off in James Joyce land, where if I don't know all of these literary allusions, I'm not going to get the book. You know, I try to put in there everything that people would need. It was an extravagant lexicon in the book, so you know, a lot of people feel like they need a dictionary, and maybe that's useful. But I think even the way the extravagant lexicon is used, you can make sense of the sentences without knowing exactly what the words mean. You can get what the speech act is or the gesture without having to, you know, open the dictionary every 30 seconds. So, you know, I hope this is more reader-friendly in some ways, although I love Pynchon, so we'll just move on.
Well, I would mention, too, that I like that we don't have to allude to anything. That's a big positive in my book. Even if I don't understand what the philosopher's talking about that you're talking about, at least it's there. But I wanted to go into something different. So we had three narratives where the language is very unique. We had Douchebag, and I make sure I'm saying this right, Pessoa.
Yes, Fernando Pessoa.
And
Pessoa, the great modernist Portuguese poet who began his great writing in about 1911 and died in 1935, just to set the historical context for Pessoa.
And then Eugene and Raymond. And actually, one of the questions I wanted to ask you about was concerning Raven. So I was an artillery observer in the United States Army, and
oh my gosh,
and your knowledge of artillery is quite phenomenal. Like I'm a veteran. I was in the first Gulf War, and as I was reading this, did you study military manuals, or are you a veteran yourself? I was just curious because, you know, I haven't heard, you know, you were talking about individual artillery rounds that he was calling in and things like that, and it's a very specific topic,
I assume that's Jeremy speaking.
Yes.
Yeah. So Jeremy, that, you know, one of my ultimate fears was always that I was going to run into somebody that actually had been involved in artillery and they would call me out on all these errors that I'd made. And, you know, so, wow, that's really something. Well, let me say just briefly that my first job out of college, I was a mathematician. My first job out of college was working at RAND, specifically at its defense analysis unit called RDA, and I built mathematical models of nuclear war and battles that involve Warsaw Pact troops invading Western Europe. And so I had to study weaponry, for 12 hours a day before I got into the mathematics of trying to model these situations. So it's, I also did a lot of research, obviously, to get updated, but this, I was hanging out with a lot of people who knew weaponry really well. I mean, every single person had Jane's Defense Weekly on their desk, and these guys would sit around. They were mostly ex-military guys, mostly colonels, and, you know, they would sit around and read about new weapons, you know, like it was the newest model automobile. And so I sort of got to know the culture, and then I did a lot of research. If you were literally a forward spotter in artillery, I that's just an amazing coincidence.
Absolutely, 100%, 13 Fox forward observer.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because when I tell people what my job was, I talk about being a veteran not out of some like weird sense of nationalism or pride, but just the fact that it was a big part of my life, and being a combat vet, it did have some influence on me. But the reason I do talk about it is because, you know, when you get into things like that, I was reading this, I'm like, how does this guy know about like Wittgenstein and artillery and like your description of geography,
corporate finance,
yeah,
pharmaceuticals. I mean, the list goes on and on.
I mean, there's so many things that you know about, but it's not like this it's not just like thrown together. It's like you have insane knowledge about these things. And that was one of the things in what I was going to get into after the artillery, but the three narratives are all individual.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have these insane descriptions of, you know, your world, the as you said, the capitalist infrastructure. We have this other guy that's, you know, wandering the streets of a city under an assumed name of a famous poet, and then these two criminals, and it's like the way it all came together. I have to say it was an amazing accomplishment, and I to touch on what you said earlier, you are easier and more accessible than Pynchon, especially his more experimental works, because I'll be honest, I'm not a fan of Pynchon, and
boo.
Yeah, and I need to try some more, so I've only done Vineland, and I couldn't get through Gravity's Rainbow.
Inherent Vice is great.
Oh, yeah.
Crying of Lot 49 is where I'm starting.
Yeah, well, we can get into all kinds of arguments. Whenever anybody asks about Pynchon, excuse me, I have a touch of laryngitis at the exact wrong time, but yeah, I usually point people to Crying a Lot 49 because you can get that sort of paranoid fiction style without having to get into the difficulties of Gravity's Rainbow. But
don't get me wrong, Jim, I love difficult books, but I just never was able to. Gravity's Rainbow and Brothers Karamazov are two I've never been able to get through.
Well,
yeah, there's a good list. You know, I hope just before we move on from your military service that you felt in my treatment of Raymond my deep respect for the people, men and women, who have served. I am not a fan, obviously, of the United States mythos of world domination via the military, and on the other hand, those who serve deserve an infinite amount of respect. And this is maybe partially from my awareness of what many of these people have gone through. The character of Raymond is actually based on somebody that I know who served in the first Gulf War, and I'll leave it at that for the moment, but I do hope that you felt that service and the way Raymond stands in the world on the next indicated action and, you know, moving forward and the bodily competence that he brings to what he does are treated with respect.
Oh, I believe so, and I'm in the same boat as you. I'm not a big rah-rah patriot guy. I was a dumb kid when I was 19. I'd flunked out of college. You know, I come from the suburbs of Detroit, so it's like you go off to school, you go work in the factories.
I
wasn't a factory guy, and at the time I wasn't. I went back and got my education later, but it got me out of town. Brought me to Chicago, so I mean, it wasn't all great, but it wasn't the worst thing in the world either. So.
Yeah, well, you didn't end up in the Juarez drug cartel, so
probably make a little more money than the Chicago Public Library.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of which, we actually have a passage introducing Raymond and Gene. Why don't we get to that? And as I mentioned, the readings are by Shanna Van Volt, and music this week is provided to us by Dos Santos. They're a great band. I hope you guys enjoy this. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. This is a reading from Jim Gower's Novel Explosives.
Raymond and Jean were getting mentally prepared to head out of Roberto's and back to the Magnum, a Viper-powered variant of the Dodge Ram flatbed that sits parked at the head of an unmarked side street directly across from a double-door entrance to a reinforced concrete smoked glass office tower. A building that even now was slowly refilling with the hard-working minions of Penny Shaved S.A. and Pauper Labor Inc., and remorseless flows of bottom feeder Capital Unlimited, most of whom, in turn, were getting mentally prepared to head out of Juarez and onto Guangxi, where a vast pool of legals out of Vietnam and Cambodia have long ago hit bottom and are prepared to work for nothing and live on thin air. The accountants and number crunchers for the local maquiladoras were returning from a good long lunch in Juarez. Looking a little buzzed on margaritas and camarones from Mariscos de Mazatlan, or maybe bourbon and T-bones from El Herradero, or Qingdao's and sweet and sour from Restaurant Shangri-La, with their suits over their shoulders and collars suddenly unbuttoned, and their half-Windsor neckties ever so slightly askew. The next indicated action for the inventory masters was to kill an hour or two in their spreadsheet cubicles, digesting these massive meals that had cost as much in 2 hours as the girls on the maquila lines made in a month, before heading home to their subdivision colonials in friendly old El Paso, and their well-groomed wives and 1.8 children and their smiles all around, "Honey, how was your day?" Meanwhile, some 14-year-old kid in a tin roof shack in Colonia de Anapra, with six brothers and sisters and an absence of any sort of semblance of plumbing, was preparing for a shift from 4 p.m. to midnight, inserting Schottky rectifiers into PCBs for power supplies that would wind up eventually, an hour or two later, in a host of enormous plasma TV screens, ideal for the recreation room of your five-bedroom duplicate of a replicant colonial. At this very minute, having swept the dirt floor and washed the dishes in a drainage ditch and hung up the laundry, she is putting on her uniform and 8 straight-hour shoes, getting ready for the dusty walk from her home made of packing crates and garbage dump salvage to her bus stop in the Colonia. An easy, though frequently deadly, 20-minute walk, where the bus will pick her up and drop her in the city center, perhaps an hour or so later, where maybe she'll find her rickety white ride to the maquila, or maybe she'll find three strangers in an ominous black Suburban. If she somehow makes it home alive, long past midnight, smelling her way along, under garbage-light stars of the Barrio Cosmos, past the angel-dusted street thugs and K-holed narco niños and buzz-bombed orphans sniffing turpentine cans, waving Armalite analog river rock carbines, she'll have earned enough rapidly shrinking Mexican currency for almost a gallon of real whole milk. Or maybe a down payment on a burlap sack of pinto beans, or nearly 2 cans of stewed tomatoes, unless, of course, she's saving up her pay for tomorrow's 70-cent round trip to the maquila. Two of her sisters will have already left for their midnight shift at the Sylvania plant, located on Calle Fulton in the immaculate Parque Industrial A. J. Bermudez assembly plant, where they too will work their way through the mind-deadening night of what the hell is this electronic componentry, having something to do with silicon-controlled rectifiers, having something to do with dimmers for lighting fixtures, having something to do eventually with something to do with light bulbs, which, while well out of reach and abundantly scarce for a family of 9 in packing crate housing, are powered by the modern miracle of pure electricity.
And that was a reading from Jim Gower's novel Explosives, kind of giving you a sense of the, I guess, the milieu around Ciudad Juarez and the people working, the maquiladoras and the factories. Jim, can you take us through a little bit of why you actually chose to set your book in this area? The book largely revolves around the USA and Mexico and the drug cartels, as we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, well, I guess Juarez itself is... particularly during the time I was writing the book, was one of the main centers of the war on drugs and was also a central place where American capitalism was being served by the assembly plants that put together modern electronics. I had an investment in a company, all of whose, that did DSL routers, so high-speed internet connections, that actually had all of its assembly done in the maquilas. So, you know, it's a center for a lot of things that intersect. The globalization, which has impoverished, among other things, something like 15 million Mexican corn growers, that led to this vast migration to the north to work in the maquila plants, and left because most of the maquiladoras employ primarily women, because they're they're much more nimble at working with small parts, and I suppose because in the Mexican culture they're much more docile, at least in theory. And in any case, it's left a sort of large pool of macho men without much employment, and this in turn fed the troops of the drug cartels that were importing drugs for consumption here in the U.S. I mean, I hope I make it clear that I don't believe Mexico is responsible for much of any of this. This is U.S. consumption. And so Juarez was, it's a frightening place. My time doing research there was, there were two truly frightening periods while I was doing research. One was doing the research on the ground in Juarez and actually going to the places where all the bodies are buried, the death houses, as they're called.
Jesus.
How did you get access? Middle-class neighborhoods where the drug lords would buy up houses and use them primarily to bury bodies. You know, 42 bodies came out of one backyard in this neighborhood that I wandered around in. And and then going out to Colonia de Anapra, which is a vast 40,000 people barrio that's just incredibly impoverished. And so it was a place with a very weird energy on top of it. So there's all the vast wealth that you can see and all of the consumerism that we pride ourselves on in America, the impoverishment of people under global capital, and the drug war being fought with a high degree of stupidity by the United States. All of these kind of converge in Juarez, and so that's where it was set.
Jim, I have to ask, you say you were just wandering around this neighborhood in Juarez. Did you just drive over or book a ticket and head around solo, or did you have somebody accompanying you?
Now, you know, the theory was my wife and I went down, checked into a Ramada Inn or something in El Paso, and I was talking to the woman at the reception desk at the Ramada, telling her I was, you know, planning to spend some time in Juarez, and what did she recommend? And her first recommendation was stay out of there. And then the next recommendation, which actually gets into the book, is when you get to the other side of the Stanton Street Bridge, you should find an information booth has maps of Juarez, because the rental car maps don't have anything on them. And so drive across the bridge, stop at the information booth, and there may be a college student there who could help guide you around Juarez. So what happens in the book is our venture capitalist, affectionately known as Douchebag to the people who are chasing him, for his sort of stupidity in wandering around Juarez, much like my stupidity in wandering around Juarez, gets to the other side of the Stanton Street Bridge and finds like an armored brigade, which is literally what I was faced with. I mean, machine guns, 50 caliber machine guns set up on jeeps, and 50 or 60 guys waving automatic weapons, and there may have been an information booth there, but I certainly didn't see it, and I was just sort of waved on into Juarez. And if you know that the other side of the Stanton Street Bridge, there are about seven streets that all converge there, and I was just sort of plunged into Juarez with no map, no guide, no nothing, other than that I had studied Juarez so much that it was probably lucky that I didn't have a map, because I would have been having to stop to refer to the map. I had a sort of mental map of the place, and so I could recognize where I was by this sort of mental map that I had. And yeah, so you know, I could find what's called the Cuernavaca subdivision, which is where the death houses are. And you know, the only other instruction, once the woman at the Ramada had told me not to go there, was don't stop at any stoplights or stop signs. You know, just keep driving, because there's been a lot of kidnappings. And so, yeah, I broke a lot of laws while I was down there, but and my wife wasn't too happy about the whole research collection. But yeah. I made a few of these trips.
Nice now, vacation, keep in mind, Jim.
Excuse me?
That's a nice vacation for your wife, Jim.
Yeah, yeah. You know, she was safe and sound in El Paso, which, by the way, is one of the lowest crime cities in the U.S. I mean, it's very quiet and peaceful, because the mayor had no interest at all in spreading violence north of the border and attracting attention.
Well, we have to take a quick break for our sponsors, but we're going to be back. We're speaking with Jim Gower, the author of Novel Explosives. And when we come out, we're going to hear another excerpt from his book. So stick around. You're going to hear some words from the folks that make this station possible. And as always, you're listening to I-94, courtesy of WLPN LP Chicago 105.5 FM. This, of course, is Lumpen Radio. We'll be right back.
Gabriela and I were eating homemade gorditas from an odd little shop tucked into an alley off the Calle Luis, down which we'd walked after the Theta encounter, past the one-hour photo store and the centuries-old Terreno hedge and the Teatro Juarez, and into the courtyard of the Don Quixote Museum, the Museo de Iconografía. The courtyard was in the interior of a beautiful custard-yellow two-story house with gleaming Tuscan columns and stone-quarried arches and a wood-railed mezzanine that overlooked the sculpture garden. There was a statue in the courtyard with an inscription written by Eulalio Ferrer, a man who was himself quite a colorful character, not only the collector of much of the Quixote memorabilia on display in various rooms of the museum's second floor, postage stamps and coins and wall clocks and chess sets, but one of the thousands of guests at Generalissimo Franco's far from colorful internment camp. In a preview of the blank shades of fascist things to come, things like Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Chelmo and Treblinka, the inscription advised that we, quote, read the Quixote. Read it at the concentration camp, as a minute hand of human hours, as a place to discover ideals that justify the craziness of genius to get back control of reason, end quote. And while this advice seemed peculiarly applicable to me after my molar-demolishing luncheon with Raul Ramirez and his masterful application of the ideals of Nazi dentistry, I was so overwhelmed by the museum itself that I set the inscription aside for the moment while I tried to absorb both my tour of the place and a few more inches of my enormous gordita. The surrounding rooms were full of hundreds of paintings and ceramics and prints and sculptures of the Don in various states of haunted lunacy, and flights of the tireless but aging imagination. An old man upright on a broken-down horse, or sitting by a fire with an immense pile of books, or asleep in a bright red sleeping cap in the midst of a splendid dream of everlasting youth, and gleaming but imaginary poetic armaments, or most haunting of all, the portrayal of Quixote in a lunatic asylum, his pale blue eyes staring off into space, his right hand slowly wearing a hole in the wall, and his left on a splendidly bound brown leather book. Nearly 800 images of the artist's search for ideals in an age of unfettered totalitarian power. When I looked at the hand wearing the hole in the wall, I couldn't help but picturing Antonio Gramsci, slowly wasting away in one of Mussolini's prisons, writing the prison notebooks on toilet paper, 3,000 pages worth of detailed drawings of the capitalist mental prisons we've built to confine ourselves, thinking, quote, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, end quote, with his own right hand clawing absently at the wall, leaving only a patch of darkness from the ink on his fingers, and dreaming of a plate of pasta, maybe, or a gordita he could hold if he could put down his pen.
A gordita. And as I mentioned at the start of this show, you were going to hear that phrase that Jim mentioned at the very start. You were going to hear Optimism of the Will again, and there it is. Anyway, you are listening to I-94. This is WLPNLP Chicago, 105.5 FM Lumpen Radio. That was a reading from the book Novel Explosives. It is out now from Zero Gram Press by Jim Gower. Jim is joining us from California on the phone. Jim, before the break, we've been talking about a lot of things, but that was a great example to me of the kind of humor that's in the book. And that was one of the passages that really lit up with me, because you contrast a guy who's rotting away in Mussolini's prison with the act of eating a delicious gordita, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. Jim, can you take us through a little bit of we talked about this at the start of the show, but I'd like to get back to it. The humor that's in this book, because we've contrasted a little bit with Pynchon, who's a little more slapstick. Yours is a little more dry. There's a little more of an edge to it. But I also think there's an absurdity to it, which I find very winning.
Yeah, boy, humor's a difficult topic, huh? Yeah,
it's a tough thing to write.
Yeah, it's... I don't think... It's sort of impossible for me to imagine, for myself, writing a novel without humor in it, because it seems to me so fundamental to our species. I mean, possibly other than dogs, I don't know many other forms of wildlife that have a sense of humor, although I have heard some parrots that seem to have quite a dry wit. But it's, it was important to me. It's part of my own makeup. It's something that I found in the course, oddly enough, of my business career was really necessary. If you go into a boardroom, I don't mean to take us too far away from the novel, but you go into a boardroom and people are humorless and kind of locked into their own ideas, and this sort of reality as a group project, as I describe it, in Silicon Valley.
That's funny. They call it. That's funny, Jim. That's actually very funny.
Yeah, you know, in Silicon Valley, they call this breathing your own exhaust. And in any case, one of the things I found after years of sort of humorless pounding on the table about something was that it was far easier to get people to start thinking creatively by sort of puncturing the seriousness with humor. And so I'm prone in board meetings to kind of bursting the self-enclosed bubble that people have gotten locked into and breathing their own exhaust. So, you know, what's humor? We'd have to, you know, go through Freud and all these other things. I don't know where that sense of humor comes from. It's certainly not something that I had a lot of when I was writing poetry, I would say. My poetry eventually got very, serious and even self-serious. And I suppose when I started writing novels, part of it was, you know, remember to have fun. I think literature, when we forget that it's, you have to be a little bit tapped back into your childhood and just have fun for it to be creative, at least for me. So I think humor is a byproduct of that. Those periods in our youth when a lot of things struck us as just fundamentally absurd. I mean, I grew up in a generation that thought anybody over 30 was, you know, fundamentally crazy, and so.
What are you talking about, Jim? That's still accurate.
yeah. Exactly. Fortunately, I'm only 28, so I get a pass.
Mike, I know you wanted to bring something up.
Yeah, we were talking about the humor of the book, and one of the things I found reoccurring throughout the entire book is this conversation it sort of has with itself, and it pokes fun at itself quite a bit. We've been talking a little bit about the difficulty of the novel, and there are quite a lot of words that I had to look up or had to read the sentence again to gather its meaning from the context. And one of those words was pleonastic. And it's a word that a character named Gomez, he's Raymond and Eugene's boss. Raymond and Eugene are gunmen. And can you
Shakespeare quoting boss? Don't <think that.
laughs> yeah, and I found that when I looked up that word to be a kind of self-referential to the book. Can you talk about the meaning of that word and maybe why you chose to take 713 pages to say what you had to say?
Yeah, so for people who haven't looked it up, pleonasm is the use of more words than are necessary to convey meaning. It would be a sort of concise definition. And it's deliberately used in reference to phrases that are useless or cliched or repetitive or whatever. So yeah, in using pleonasm, the book is, in some sense, sort of poking fun at itself, you know, this sort of vast outpouring of language. And it's also, you know, the book is obviously written at a strange angle, maybe even orthogonal to most contemporary fiction, I would say. Corporate fiction is my favorite term for it, stuff that is put out by the big publishing houses who have to watch the bottom line and make sure that books sell well. Most of these, the popular style that's evolved is linear narrative, sort of very simple use of sentences, declarative sentence, transitional phrase, declarative sentence, new paragraph, declarative sentence, new paragraph. And, you know, this kind of sparse minimalism that fits, you know, worked very well, I think, back when it was first put in use and is really masterful in the hands of somebody like Joy Williams or many others.
Sounds like an indictment of Gordon Lish here.
Yeah, well, okay. Lish is the hatchet job on Raymond Carver is a whole long topic, but yeah. I happen to love Gordon Lish's own work. I'm not so big a fan of what he did to Carver's work. But all of that said, you know, the book is obviously a sort of overkill of that style of writing that aims to be, I would call it Orwellian prose, meaning a sort of transparent window onto the world. The language is very much foregrounded. There's a lot of it, and it's a kind of deliberate transgression of the norms of contemporary fiction that appear to me often to be written to, you know, the literacy level of a high school student. And, you know, I should stay out of that because I'll insult way too many people. But
that's okay.
Yeah, well, it's certainly clear that if you want to sell a lot of books, you better aim for a lower common denominator than I did.
Absolutely.
You know, I sold way more of this than I ever expected to, but it's, yeah, you're not going to end up being the top title pushed by Random House if you write this way. So, you know, just a warning to anybody who likes novel explosives, don't write like that.
Well, Jim, I asked you in an email if it was okay if I brought up some criticism from Goodreads, and I wanted to read you this one because it's kind of funny, but it's sort of, I feel like a lot of readers take this kind of stance towards fat novels, and the title of this guy's criticism was "The Neophyte's Guide to Yet Another Made-to-Order Big Fat Brainy Encyclopedic American Novel Part 9 and Counting." How to get 5 stars for your encyclopedic novel from the herd of independent minds. 1. Make sure your sentences average half to 1 page in length. 2. Make sure your paragraphs extend to 4.5 pages. 3. Drop the names of Hegel, Heidegger, Wittgenstein, and or Lacan into the text gratuitously. 4. Randomly use polysyllabic words you found in your dictionary, but never encountered or used before. 5. Quote liberally from your American physician's desk reference.
Mike, can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
I just want to say that I would bet $100 that this reviewer did not read the book.
Well, it's interesting because he or she made sure they made it long enough to let you know that they did read the entirety of the book. And
I just lost 100 bucks.
Well, wow. Thank you. What I found really discouraging about it was the fact that this person clearly has the capacity to understand some of the themes that are explored in the book, but found it necessary to be catty about who's the smarter person.
Also, yeah. I'll drop another 100 that they're a failed writer. Boom.
I wonder if you had encountered this type of attitude. And
well, you know, I think it's part of the contemporary debate that's been going on for the last 10 or 15 years that, you know, we had sort of Jonathan Franzen on one side of this, and then, you know, sort of the defenders of, let's say, more innovative fiction on the other. And, you know, Franzen makes a good case against the kind of writing that I'm doing.
Oh, Mr. Difficult was his essay.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So he's referring specifically to William Gaddis.
Right.
And while, you know, Gaddis's first book, The Recognitions, is pretty difficult, and, you know, it's 1,100 pages long or something, if you guys have read J.R., I think
yes,
J.R. Yeah. is just hilarious. And
couldn't finish it.
You know, not in any way. Well, it has its difficulties, but it's not.
I found a lot of similarities, actually, between novels and J.R.
But I finished Novel Explosives, and I couldn't finish J.R. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. I won't comment on that. But in any case, you know, that kind of critique is, you know, it's certainly fair. I mean, everyone has a right to their own aesthetic. You know, to think that I sort of deliberately wrote this way to appeal to some audience that he's imagined of kind of pseudo-intellectuals is certainly not what I was doing. I mean, this book took 7 years of 7 days a week. I mean, literally not a day skipped.
Before work.
Getting up at 4 a.m, writing for at least 6 hours, and then on top of that, all the research. I mean, I didn't write this book to, you know, try to put myself on the map of pseudo-intellectuals. These are things that, if you actually have read the book with some sympathy, these are things I deeply care about and believe in. And while I obviously have an aesthetic that likes more extravagance in their books, it's, you know, it wasn't calculated. So I think the only thing I would disagree with is sort of the tone of that critique.
Yeah.
A serious aesthetic critique of the book could be written along those lines, and I would certainly probably agree with it. That would be fine. I mean, I read a lot of novels that aren't written this way, and they're fine. I think it's the difference between maybe it's lovely to take a hike through rolling countryside and I have some behind my house. It's also a lot of fun to climb a 500-foot rock face, you know, with just a few nuts and bolts and a little rope attached to yourself. And I was a rock climber for a long time. So this is a rock climb. It's not a
Let me just say this, Jim.
Jim, I'm going to trust you, first of all, that you think rock climbing's fun. I'm just going to I'll trust you on that.
And I'm going to say this. You went to the death houses in Juarez to do research. This isn't just some, like, you know, intellectual fart job. I just made that word up.
That was good. That was good.
But, like, you know what I mean? And I think the book was, well, and, you know, we're talking about the artillery. You know, I was reading, I'm like, how does this dude know this? You know what I mean? And it's like, that's, to me, is like, you researched, you wrote day in and day out. You don't have to like this kind of book. And if you don't like it, put it down. That's why I hate social media criticism sites. That's why we started this radio show, so I could present a book like Novel Explosives, or we, not me, could present a book like Novel Explosives to the public that might not have heard about it, because stuff like this needs to be read, because we're all reading what you call corporate literature, what we call hot garbage.
Amen.
And with that, we actually are running out of time. The one thing about this show is that it flies by. And I do want to leave our listeners with one last clip from Jim Gower's book. Let's give Jim the last word. You're going to be hearing from, again, Jim Gower's book, Out on Zero Gram Press, Novel Explosives. And, of course, we've been talking to him for the last hour. Jim, thank you so much.
Jim. Thank you. It's been a
real
pleasure.
Really appreciate it, your insights. And we did really enjoy the book here on the show.
I hope I didn't scare the whole audience off. And in any case, it was great talking with you guys.
You as
thank
well.
Thank you so much. We're going to be back in 2 weeks, right? 2 weeks, is that right?
No, next week.
Next week. Oh, I can't even keep up with what's going on in this show. But next thing you're going to hear is the final clip from Novel Explosives by Jim Gower. I am Jamie Trecker for Jeremy Kitchen. Michael Sack. We'll see you next week. You're listening to I-94 and WLPNLP Chicago 105.5 FM. This is Lumpin' Radio.
So let's just say the bookings came roaring in with upfront cash to solve our little burn problem from third world countries that none of us had heard of. Lesotho, Eritrea, Comoros, Guinea-Bissau, and places like Malawi and Suriname and Timor-Leste, places from a fifth grade geography quiz where you're supposed to match the country to the name of the continent. Do you know the difference between Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan in terms of which would be most interested in buying UFDMA packet-based downlinks? If the government of Turkmenistan ordered enough power amplifiers to blanket the Black Sands Desert with solar-powered cell phone towers, would you find that a little odd? How much do you actually know about 3GPP long-term evolution? If I told you it used EUTRAN on the network core side of the evolved packet system and EPC on the access side, would you be able to tell me that I had it backwards? Exactly. Me either. Have you ever heard of companies like HTNL, IGO, TOT Corp, and Inforta, as opposed to companies like HNL and Bartos and Cordian and Wish Wireless? I'll give you a hint. Some of these are real and actually deploying WiMAX networks, and some of these are not so real and probably deploying an elaborate smokescreen. If you're sitting in a board meeting and the CEO tells you that they're selling a bunch of power amplifiers through a company named Infocom for WiMAX systems in Kampala, Uganda, you should probably start feeling pretty good about yourself. If the CEO says new orders have just come in with payment in advance for SF-FDMA uplink amplifiers purchased by Velocicom for Paramaribo, Suriname, you might want to call a lawyer who speaks a little Dutch and knows a fair amount about the bauxite industry. Like how to turn bauxite into an aluminum explosive and hide most of Suriname under a dense cloud of smoke, because you yourself will have no way of knowing whether these orders are real or not. Real? How can they not be real if somebody actually paid for them? What could be more real than cash up front? I-94 is Lumpin' Radio's books and literature program, airing every Sunday at 11 a.m. Central. This episode featured Jim Gower's book, Novel Explosives, out now from Zero Gram. The episode originally aired on April 15th, 2018. I-94 is a Lumpin' Radio production, with readings by Shanna Van Volt, show intro and promo voiced by David Green, music by Laurie Johnson and Bill Bennett from the KPM Archive. For more information on I-94 and for past episodes, visit eye94.org. For more information on Lumpin' Radio, visit lumpinradio.com.